Senator Begich got into the Senate race long before Senator Stevens' legal troubles began.
Republicans call for Senator Begich to step down, but he says he is staying put. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 2nd of April. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, legal analysts wait for the other shoe to drop in the Stevens case.
This whole incident does raise really a larger question about what is going to happen now to the public integrity section of the Justice Department. It needs to be cleaned out, root and branch.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all-suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080.
Governor Sarah Palin and the Alaska Republican Party are calling for Senator Mark Begich to step down. They say his election win in November was influenced by the guilty verdict in the Ted Stevens case, a verdict that will soon be thrown out. But as APRN's Libby Casey reports, Begich has no plans to give up his seat.
Republican Party Chair Randy Riedrich says Senator Begich's election win was tainted by the Stevens verdict. Stevens was convicted just 1 week before last fall's Senate race, which he lost by fewer than 4,000 votes. On Wednesday, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder called for Stevens' conviction to be thrown out and the charges to be dropped because of misconduct by prosecutors. However, the fact that Stevens is 85 years old and no longer a public servant in the Senate likely factored into Holder's decision not to pursue a new trial. Riedrich says, even so, he wants to see Begich resign so a special election can be called.
I would like to see him elected on a fair playing field. We can do this over without the pall of a conviction that has been now deemed to be improper over the election.
Governor Sarah Palin said in an email to APRN that she agrees. She said many voters did not choose Stevens because they were told he was guilty. She wrote that she'd like to see an election free from, quote, improper influence, and said she, quote, can't imagine how Mark Begich could argue that. But the Republican Party can't force a special election. Shelley Groudon with the Division of Elections explains.
The way the state law reads is a candidate or any person who requested a recount and believed there was an error in the recount could then appeal to court. That doesn't apply in this situation. There was no recount in that race.
Senator Begich has no intention of stepping down. His office says the senator is honored to serve for the next 6 years and work on issues like fixing the economy. Spokeswoman Julie Haskett.
Senator Begich got into the Senate race long before Senator Stevens' legal troubles began because Alaskans were looking for a change and a senator as independent as Alaska.
The Alaska Democratic Party says the call for Begich to resign is outrageous. Communications Director Kay Brown says Begich didn't take advantage of Stevens' legal troubles and did not focus on them during the campaign.
Mark never made an issue of that, and that was not what he was fundamentally offering. He was offering new leadership, better ideas, and an opportunity for Alaskans to have a seat at the Democratic table in Congress and in the new administration.
The National Democratic Party did run ads in Alaska during the campaign referring to Stevens' indictment. In Washington, sympathy for Stevens is running high. Democratic Senator Carl Levin from Michigan says it's sad Stevens was caught up in a defective prosecution. But Levin says that's not Senator Begich's fault. He says Begich should not step down and has nothing to apologize for.
There's nothing for him to make amends for. He ran for office not for anything other than his own capabilities and his own experience as a mayor, so he's got nothing to make amends for. As the prosecutors do in the Department of Justice, and that was under a Republican administration, by the way, so maybe they should call for President Bush or whoever was in the Justice Department that he appointed to be making amends, but there's nothing for Senator Begich to be making amends for.
Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski responded with a statement saying that in light of Wednesday's bombshell from the Justice Department, many people, quote, wish we could turn the clock back to November. Unfortunately, that is not an option. One of Ted Stevens' most ardent supporters, Alaska Congressman Don Young, says there is no point in asking Begich to step down.
Senator Begich, in all due respects, won the race. And I'm not going to take a position. People are going to be asking him to do things. But, you know, there's no other recourse than what he's already done. He's taken the oath of office. And, you know, he's now the new senator. I don't see any real constructive other than a lot of noise that would come out of trying to say, well, he ought to resign or something like that. I just don't think that's going to happen.
Congressman Young says it's a shame Alaska lost Stevens as a senator and does blame the conviction for his loss. Young says he'd like to see Stevens return to politics, but perhaps in a different role.
Personally, I'd like to see him run for governor. And that's my personal feeling. And so we'll see what happens down the line. He probably won't, but I think that'd be a great way to cap off a great career as being the governor of the state of Alaska.
The governor's seat will be up for election next year. At this point, Ted Stevens is not talking to reporters. He will appear in public next Tuesday when he attends a Washington court hearing to throw out his convictions. In Washington, with help from Rosemary Alexander, I'm Libby Casey.
Former Senator Ted Stevens' friends and old colleagues in the Senate were floored by the Attorney General's decision yesterday to drop the federal case against him. His fellow Republicans were quick to praise Stevens and lamented that the guilty verdict came down right before his failed election bid. One of Stevens' closest friends in the Senate, Utah's Orrin Hatch, says he was thrilled to hear yesterday's news and called Stevens right away.
I called him up in Alaska, and he was elated, naturally. Elated, but naturally very disappointed that all of these things have happened to, you know, to destroy his great reputation.
Hatch testified at Stevens' trial last fall as a character witness. He's worried about the amount of money Stevens has had to spend during the investigation, trial, and its aftermath.
This has cost him a fortune, but one thing for sure, somebody should pay his legal costs.
Hatch did not specify who should be responsible for Stevens' mounting legal bills. He calls the Justice Department's actions unforgivable. Former Kansas Senator Bob Dole was on Capitol Hill today and said his fellow World War II veteran got a raw deal.
Got robbed, got ripped off, disaster, lost a seat because of a heavy-handed Justice Department.
At 85, Dole is the same age as Ted Stevens and says he doesn't see how his former colleague can gain back what he's lost. There are lots of looming legal questions over the Justice Department's decision to dismiss the Stevens conviction. For some answers, we turn to Gerald Hebert, executive director of the Campaign Legal Center in Washington, D.C. Hebert is a former federal prosecutor himself, and he says he was puzzled the attorney general didn't call for a new trial.
After all of the misconduct that had been reported by the prosecution team, I thought that the Justice Department would simply agree with the defense lawyers that there really needed to be a start over, a new trial. And I was a little surprised that based on the prosecution's misconduct, alone and maybe the age of the defendant and the cost of going through a new trial. I think those were all factors, but I still was surprised by it.
So the mistakes made by the prosecution team were pretty big. How big? I mean, is there a comparison in your mind to anything like what went down during the Stevens trial?
I spent over 20 years as a federal prosecutor myself, and I have to say that not turning over documents as a prosecutor to the other side in a criminal case that clearly were required to be turned over is really a kind of a law school student mistake rather than a seasoned prosecutor mistake, especially in a case involving a high-profile defendant like Senator Stevens. You really want to make sure as a prosecutor that you are not accused of ever withholding evidence or any other impropriety, and you really probably want to go overboard in the effort to be fair in such a case.
We're still calling the prosecution's conduct misconduct, and you're saying there were the types of mistakes made by someone like a first-year law student who had no experience. Maybe they weren't mistakes.
Well, one has to wonder, given the level of experience that these prosecutors really had at the Department of Justice, why they would make such elementary mistakes in a case like this. The Office of Professional Responsibility, which is the ethics watchdog within the Justice Department and which is fiercely independent, now has the matter under review and will conduct a complete investigation of the conduct here. I think the whole incident, though, really calls into question the Office of Public Integrity, which is really the office these original prosecutors came from. As Judge Sullivan, I think, himself put it at one point, he doubted whether the Office of Public Integrity had any public integrity after what he saw they were doing in the Stevens trial.
So what might happen to these miscreant prosecutors?
Well, it really depends on whether they knew and were doing things purposefully to deceive the other side or whether or not they were just being inadvertent and sloppy. The Office of Professional Responsibility will determine that. If it's the former, that it was an intentional deception by the prosecution to withhold documents from the other side and that they knew what they were doing and they knew that it was a violation of the rules, then the consequences will be dramatic. It could include, for example, dismissal from the Department of Justice. It could include sanctions by the state bar of whoever they happen to have their bar memberships. So there are some real serious consequences. And, of course, if they were to if the conduct were actually rises to the level of obstruction of justice, they could face prosecution themselves.
Gerald Hebert is executive director of the Campaign Legal Center, a nonprofit that provides research and analysis of campaign-related cases and laws. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Sitka High School students work to extract DNA from muskeg.
All of them are actually doing original research, and this gives the opportunity for juniors and seniors to go on and do stuff that no one else has done.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
The House today passed one of Governor Palin's top priority bills, a measure requiring parental consent before underage women can get an abortion. The bill by North Pole Republican John Coghill said the state courts had ruled the state's previous law as too restrictive. He said the current bill offers as much protection as possible to parents who have an interest in their daughter's condition and protection for young women without parental support.
This gives some protection to the minor by having somebody look over the shoulder of this very important decision. Without this, we actually have some very vulnerable youngsters out there. So I am convinced, Mr. Speaker, that this is the better way to go. And but that I am not saying that this is the only way to go, and I'm not saying this is the answer to all ills.
Anchorage Democrat Lindsey Holmes opposed the bill, saying it targets vulnerable teenaged women, those who do not talk with or get support from their parents. She said those women are already in jeopardy.
Home can be a really scary place, Mr. Speaker, for a lot of girls, a lot of boys in this state. It can be a scary and unsafe place. And this bill, in those cases, Mr. Speaker, gives the power to exactly the wrong person. It gives the power to the parents who have made that place unsafe, who may even be responsible for the unplanned pregnancy in the worst of circumstances.
The bill next will go to the Senate for consideration. Mount Edgecombe's molecular ecology students are sweeping science fairs and symposiums across the state with their work on DNA extraction in the muskeg ecosystem of the Tongass. As KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports, a few of the students will now travel to national competitions to present their research and represent Alaska with some of the first findings ever from this part of the world.
Stephanie Thompson is originally from Kotzebue, and she looks like your average just-turned 18-year-old. She's wearing plaid sneakers and a striped scarf, and little skull earrings dangle from her ears. But then she starts talking about her science project.
It's called A Molecular Phylogenetic Study of Archaea from a Muskeg in Southeast Alaska.
And she's lost me already.
Can you define phylogenetic? The
noun is phylogeny, and phylogeny is the study of evolutionary relationships of the species that you're studying. You know, it's the DNA of species from millions of years ago is going to be very different from the DNA of the descendant species of today.
We're trying to figure out who's out there in the muskegs.
Kitty Labonte is a botanist and one of the mentors for Mount Edgecombe's Molecular Ecology Program. Labonte says the research the students are doing in the lab at Mount Edgecombe provides baseline data that can be used to understand ecosystem functions.
All these things are really important in nutrient cycles and within the muskeg, how those plants actually grow, how some of the organic matter is decomposed, basically very intrinsic pieces and parts of the ecosystem, and we don't know anything about them in this particular area. So that's why we have that focus.
Senior Christopher Liu is originally from Bethel. He's looking at fungi on a rare patanthera, also called rain orchid or bog orchid. The question he wants to know is whether these rain orchids are rare in the muskeg because its fungi is rare, or is it something else?
So just understanding that these plants have an extreme dependence on fungi itself and that they wouldn't survive without it is vital. And there's basically little to no research on these mycorrhizal associates, specifically in the patanthera of southeast Alaska.
Liu says he likes knowing that he's on the cutting edge of research that has never been done before, and he feels like he's contributing to the scientific world.
Having this research for the use of the future researchers, such as those that study climate change specifically, in the case that the muskeg or the Sitka spruce ecosystem were to change due to increasing temperatures, then we would be able to have something to compare to in the past.
Climate change and cutting-edge research is also Stephanie Thompson's impetus for her research on archaea, those bacteria-like microbes that aren't really bacteria, which she mentioned before.
Archaea in the muskeg and in the tongass have never been studied before. And the tongass, it's a huge carbon sink, and one type of archaea are methanogens. They produce methane, which is a greenhouse gas. And just the size of the ecosystem, you know, with enough methane emissions from the microbes in the ecosystem, it could play some role in climate change, and also the being a carbon sink could also have a role.
Archaea, as it turns out, are these single-cell organisms that are often found in extreme places like hot springs or deep ocean vents. But Kitty Labonte says they haven't been well studied, and so in that sense, it's not too surprising that Thompson is the first one to find and document her research. On the other hand, these are juniors and seniors in high school.
All of them are actually doing original research. A lot of what happens in high schools is you get to repeat things that are already known. And that's a good beginning exercise because learning scientific method is important. But in this gives the opportunity for juniors and seniors to go on and do stuff that no one else has done.
And that opportunity is basically credited to retired Mount Edgecombe teacher Martin Johnson, who got the program going about 7 years ago. Chola Mole has inherited the lab and the program from Johnson and is now in her fourth year teaching at Edgecombe.
There's only one other lab like this in a high school, and I believe there's one in Hawaii. So it's pretty amazing that the kids get to work in their own school in a genetics lab.
Mole says selling the kids on muskeg research was a bit of a process. Most of the kids are from interior villages, and muskegs aren't really crowd pleasers compared with whales or eagles, subjects this lab has researched in the past. But as these kids have traveled around the state to science competitions, they realize that what they're contributing is really cutting-edge science. Stephanie Thompson is on the verge of being the first Mount Edgecombe student to have her findings published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The Fairbanks Catholic Diocese has filed a plan for paying victims of abuse by clergy. The compensation plan is the latest step in a diocese Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization spurred by abuse claims. Diocese attorney Casey Nye says the fund, which could top $30 million, includes $8.6 million derived from church real estate.
Essentially, all of its property in one form or another, and they're committing themselves to over $400,000 a year of debt service for the next 20 years.
Nye says essential diocese buildings in Fairbanks and Galena will be mortgaged, with the proceeds going to a compensation fund for 300 victims who've filed abuse claims against the diocese. The fund would also include money from the sale of various other properties, including an airplane and hangar in Fairbanks, KNOM radio in Nome, and development rights to Pilgrim Hot Springs. Nye says two Catholic schools in Fairbanks and parish churches are not part of the proposal, nor is an endowment trust that supports parish operations. Plaintiff's attorney Ken Rosa says the over $10 million endowment fund should be tapped to pay victims.
They don't commit any of the millions of dollars that they've hidden away in illegal trust funds. The plan, at its very bottom, shows absolutely no concern at all for the hundreds of victims that it purports to reach out to.
Rosa is also critical of the diocese handling of insurance claims. Diocese attorney Nye says the claims are disputed but are expected to make up the bulk of the compensation.
The insurance is going to depend on the liability of the insurance companies, which is contested in the case. But there are some substantial sums in excess of $20 to $27 million that are possible.
Nye says the diocese is waiving any barrier the statute of limitations poses to claimants who typically suffered abuse as children. The church's plan also lays out criteria for victim compensation based on the severity of the abuse they suffered. Rosa says the classification system is unfair and impersonal.
Not to have the victims interviewed and evaluated individually, but to arbitrarily classify them and let the church decide, it's outrageous.
Attorneys on both sides of the case, as well as insurance companies and church and victims' representatives, are required to participate in mediation talks later this month. The diocese compensation plan will be a starting point for the negotiations. What happens when a one-football-team town becomes a two-football-team town? KTOO's Rebecca Shear introduces us to the Thunder Mountain High School Falcons, the newest kickers on the block, and explores how Juneau's football scene will change now that the Crimson Bears have a bit of company.
We are the Falcons, the mighty, mighty Falcons. We are the Falcons, the flying fish-eating Falcons.
Thunder Mountain sophomore Jesse Conrad Nakamura is not a songwriter.
That's all I got.
That's not bad.
I'm working on it.
But he is a football player.
Football, I love the sport.
And today he's in spring training for his high school football debut as a founding member of
the mighty, mighty Falcons.
As TMHS enters its second year, it will be one of 212 schools in the Alaska School Activities Association. That means it can compete against other ASAA members across the state, provided they're in the same conference. TMHS is 4A, since it enrolls more than 401 students. But with less than 850 students, football-wise, it's considered a small school, unlike a certain other Juneau team. What's the relationship going to be between the Crimson Bears and the Falcons? They're not going to play each other the first year, right, because of the different conferences?
They're not playing the first year.
Though they will be playing the second year, once Juneau Douglas's enrollment levels out and it, too, becomes a small school. This, by the way, is Bill Boyer,
head coach of Thunder Mountain High School football,
and the former junior varsity coach at Juneau Douglas. JDHS is currently recruiting a new one. Boyer's first order of business with the Falcons, other than getting through spring training, is raising funds.
We're keeping the cost down out of pocket to the kids in regards to making it $300 for them to play.
Each Crimson Bear will personally pay $1,400 this coming year. That's down from $1,440 last year. The money covers things like activity fees, registration costs, and travel for themselves and their opponents.
They have to come up with money to have these teams travel in. They have to come up with money to travel out. And we are making it a status quo that we're not going to pay for teams to come in to play here like JDHS has done. It's too high of a cost for our kids in this community to play sports.
So Boyer says the Falcons will primarily be playing other teams in Southeast.
And I believe that there's a lot of down south teams that will come up and play.
In other words, teams from the lower 48. Financially, the Falcons and Bears aren't entirely on their own. The Juneau Youth Football League will continue its mission of overseeing all divisions of Juneau football by assisting the teams with fundraising. After 2 years, it'll let JDHS and TMHS manage the high school division together. In the meantime, the Juneau School District is also helping out by paying for a fraction of both teams' travel.
We're striving for equity in every way we possibly can, but there are only so many boys to go around.
Bill Chalmers has coached the Crimson Bears for 5 years.
We've, in the past, have planned on suiting up 70 to 75 boys in both varsity and junior varsity. This year, we're counting on having 50. The remainder of that number will hopefully be playing for Thunder Mountain High School.
Notice how he says, will hopefully be playing for Thunder Mountain. It appears that Chalmers isn't exactly bemoaning a loss of talent to his team. The same team, mind you, that nabbed the statewide large schools championship in both 2005 and 2007.
The Bears have had a winning tradition just about every year since they've had high school football. But any of my football players who wanted to play for Thunder Mountain, I would say, go for it. They need positive building blocks to build on, and our kids are great kids, and they would make great building blocks.
Even if that could be at the expense of your winning streak.
Well, winning isn't everything.
Chalmers says he knows people are worried about a town of 31,000 people fielding two football teams.
I don't want the town to be torn apart by their football program. The football program has been a real positive aspect of my experience in Juneau. And I want to stay that way.
Which is why once he retires from coaching in 2010, he vows to attend as many Thunder Mountain games as he can.
Just because I want to see good football. And I'm sure that these coaches will have good football teams right from the very beginning.
The Falcons have only been training for 6 weeks, but Coach Boyer says they're off to a promising start. He's got 25 on board so far, enough for a varsity team, though he'd love to have at least 50 so he could field a JV team, too. A handful of his crew are former Crimson Bears, all of them excited about beginning a new tradition.
This first team that's going to play are going to have their pictures on the walls for the rest of their lives. Anybody who's going ahead and playing for Thunder Mountain this first season is going to be part of history and part of tradition for the rest of their lives.
The Falcons play their first game on August 8th against the Sitka Wolves, and Jesse Conrad Nakamura says he'll be prepared in more ways than one.
And the song that you wrote now, are you going to have it all down by the first game, maybe?
Yes, I will have it down. I'll sing it at the first game.
And depending on which way the score goes, perhaps all the Falcons will have something to sing about. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
Mount Redoubt has quieted down this week, but it still continues to rumble and grumble. The Coast Guard says plans are underway to draw down some of the 6 million gallons of oil in two storage tanks at the Drift River Terminal, 22 miles downriver from the exploding volcano, on Saturday. A tanker will be brought to a platform near the terminal to offload some of the oil from the tanks. Officials said some oil needs to remain in the tanks to prevent them from becoming buoyant and floating away if there is a flood. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Rosemarie Alexander and Rebecca Shear in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our Vice President of Public Media Content. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.